Standing here, Dr. Mary J. Ruart, author of Healing Our World and Short Answers to Tough Questions. There's really four questions here. Shouldn't take too long. Mm-hmm. The first few are from Earthborn.
Okay.
In Chapter 2 of Healing Our World, you compare the free market to a rainforest ecosystem. But ecosystems are not free from aggression. In fact, aggression is what makes them work. Every individual organism takes whatever he wants, usually causing the death of another. Don't you think that comparing the free market with rainforest plays right into the hands of those who claim that libertarianism will lead to the law of the jungle?
Well, of course, it is an analogy, a metaphor, not an exact replica.
Right.
So, in using that analogy, I'm really focusing more on the fact that things are balanced out. They come to there's give and take, and I don't mean take in the aggressive sense. I mean it in the sense of adjustment. And in that sense, I think it's a good analogy. You are right in that across species, the different species use aggression against each other, just as we eat animals, for example. And it actually makes for a very interesting discussion on animal rights, which I've gotten into on a number of occasions. And I'm not sure how to take libertarianism across species because of that.
Yeah.
But I think it's a very interesting question, and I hope someone will come up with a better way of thinking through that and having principles that we can apply as easily as we apply the libertarian principles to each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that makes sense. I've always thought with animal rights, though, because you can't have rights without responsibilities. Yeah, we don't let the bull in the china shop. Because, well, I mean, you can ask, you probably heard what happened to Roy Horn, the Siegfried and Roy, when he was attacked by one of his tigers, mm-hmm. tragic thing. And that was someone who knew tigers and was mm-hmm. trained tiger, and the tiger still couldn't be trusted to be responsible.
Yes, if that's what happened. I've heard different versions of that, that the tiger thought he was protecting him and pulling him off stage and just grabbed him in the wrong place. But I don't know,
heard
I wasn't
that.
There.
Well, I haven't heard that, and I've talked to some people who are a little closer to it, and they haven't said anything like it, so
okay,
no, I'm thinking it was...
You probably know more than I do.
Well, probably not much more, but you know. Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Second question, also from Earthborn. On your figures for the deaths caused by the FDA's tardy approval of propranolol, mm-hmm. how did you figure out the number of people saved by the FDA, and how can you be certain it's less than the number of people killed?
Okay, well, the propranolol study was done by Arthur D. Little, and so they actually determined that propranolol was saving 10,000 lives a year. But it was available in Europe before it was available in the U.S. for 3 years. And even when it came to the U.S., it was only available for limited indications, which means that most doctors didn't prescribe it for its most life-saving uses unless they were aware of what was happening in Europe. So,
but does that mean the doctors could have prescribed it if they
had
known about it?
They could have had they known, but the drug manufacturers are prohibited from telling the doctors about it.
Right.
FDA law. So unless they, you know, heard about what was going on in Europe because they read their medical journals or something, they would not have done that. Now, of course, we always hope our doctors are updated, but the truth of the matter is they're usually so busy that they aren't. And we had the three-year delay of it getting into the country, and then we probably had several years more. I think it was maybe 10 years. I'd have to actually check the actual numbers before it was actually approved for the major indications. Now, So basically, it's well known that the numbers of people who die from propranolol are much fewer than the numbers that are saved. I've also done further research since then that Earthbound might be interested in, and that is I looked and tried to see how many adverse reactions actually created death or serious injury before the 1962 amendments, which really beat the FDA up. And the number of...
And that was when they added on testing for efficacy as well as...
That's right. And they also made the FDA examiners actually sign off on each new drug, whereas before, companies would simply submit their data to the FDA, and if the FDA didn't find anything wrong with it, then they would market the drug. But once the FDA examiners had to put their name on the approvals, of course, they were very frightened because every drug has some side effects.
Right.
Every drug. So they knew they were going to get into trouble if anything was wrong with this drug. So they demanded more and more testing, and drug testing has gone from about 4.5 years before the amendments to about 14.5 years after. So we're talking a 10-year delay for life-saving drugs. You can actually do the calculation. It comes out to be probably 4.7 million people have died waiting for drugs for that extra 10-year period. And the number of people that might have been saved, if we'd have saved every single person that would have been killed had the amendments not come into being, using the numbers from before the amendments, the absolute most, if every one of those people had been saved, and even if thalidomide had been thrown in there, would have been something like 90,000 people. So 90,000 versus 4.7 million. And I haven't even talked about the other effects of these amendments. In fact, if you go to my website, you can find out more about this. And the address is www.ruart.com/AAPS.PDF
And AAPS.PDF.
That's correct. And, yes. And if you go there, what you'll find is a PDF poster of a presentation that I gave at the American Association for Pharmaceutical Sciences in November, where I actually calculate the cost-benefit ratio of the 1962 Kiefer-Harris amendments to the FDA Food and Drug Act, basically.
Okay.
And you can see all these numbers for yourself.
Is there a good breakdown of how the numbers were actually calculated?
Yes, yes. Actually, and you can actually do them yourself if you'd like. There are some, there's a few little assumptions and things like that that were made that may not appear on the poster, but of course you can always email me if you get into that and have a question. There is like one error on the poster and you'll catch it in the table, but most of it's pretty easy to see.
I'm just wondering how much of that you can put in the table, but I'll check it out.
Yeah, yeah, it's actually, well, see, the thing is, it's actually a big poster. It was originally a something like 4 feet by 3 feet, and you have to press that little plus button in the PDF display in order to enlarge it enough to read it section by section. Just letting you know that. So when so when your listeners go there, they actually can find it.
Okay. And third question also from Earthborn. Do you think a libertarian society is possible if only a minority of people actually want to be free, free as defined by libertarians? If the majority of people is able to tolerate authoritarianism, how can authoritarian leaders ever lose their power? I think that's a good question.
Well, that's an excellent question. Well, and there's several ways to answer that. I mean, first of all, I think most people are followers. So I think that if the prevailing societal influence is authoritarian, most people will line up with the authoritarians. If the prevailing societal influence is for freedom, I think most people will line up that way. So I think it really depends on what's out there that people are hearing about. And of course, for many years, they've heard an increasingly intense authoritarian message. They've heard it in schools, our newspapers, our universities, radio for a large extent, television. That's all been kind of oriented in an authoritarian way. I believe that's changing for a number of reasons. And one of the biggest influences, of course, is the Internet.
Yeah.
For example, you're hearing this, or I presume if you're listening, you're hearing this on the Internet now. I'm recording it in a room somewhere else. And I can talk to everyone that's accessing this without being physically present. This would not have been possible, certainly as easily, certainly 100 years ago, it would have been impossible. But even in more recent times, if I weren't at a radio station or a television station, you couldn't have heard it, and you would have heard it. You would have had a limited window of time during which you could have heard it. And now it can sit out there on the Internet, and people all around the world, thousands, even millions, can listen to this if they choose. So we're changing to a society where it's hard to keep a secret.
Yeah.
All the information's going to be out there. Now, it's true you may have to cull through a lot of information, but I think once the message of freedom gets to a person, they go, aha, yes, that's it. And so I am encouraged that there is not only, I think, does the average person's heart long for freedom, even though they might not understand it in its totality, but the message of freedom will be out there and available to anyone without the internet. And that is, I think, something that we really have going for us.
Well, I agree with that, and I'm very excited about that, but at least the way it seems to be now, the stuff on the internet, you kind of have to go and seek out. Whereas it's easy for a lot of people just to sit home, leave the TV, tune to Fox News or CNN or something, and get everything that way.
Well, it is, and that's what I'm saying. That's the authoritarian message out there. But however, you know, the message used to be, you know, back 100 years ago, the message changed from one of freedom to one of socialism. And I think that the crux of the matter was this. people said, well, freedom is wonderful, but, you know, it doesn't work in the real world. It doesn't help people who, you know, are starving in the streets, or it doesn't help when a company has a bad product. It doesn't help here, there, and there. And so the solution is more regulation, more taxes, more government. Well, one of the nice things about the Internet is that there's a lot of research now appearing showing that actually government works worse than freedom. Yes, freedom's not perfect, but government is worse. So that information is becoming so pervasive that people like the World Bank, hardly a libertarian organization, which used to say things like, oh, growth can be bad for the poor because the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, are now saying just the opposite. They've done the studies, and now you can go to their website and you can see what they say. And basically what they say is, you know, growth is good for the poor. Growth lifts them up. And, in fact, growth lifts them up more than it lifts up the rich, usually. And the reason, which they haven't quite got, but they're coming very close to, is that you get growth when you have more freedom. They're even coming to that. They're talking about, oh, you get growth when you have good governance. What is good governance? Well, if you look at what they call good governance, you see it's a lot of the things that are related to freedom. When individual rights are respected, property rights are respected, when the law is consistent. In other words, it's the laws that apply to everybody, not just certain segments of the population. So all the things that libertarians would say, yes, this is good governance, we agree, are the things that they're finding are good for growth and good for the poor.
Yeah.
So we're seeing a shift because of the knowledge out there, and that's all out on the Internet.
Well, I've noticed already that on that subject, even the Politicos have changed their rhetoric. It's not the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. They talk about the widening gap between rich and poor, which, you know, if you know anything at all about statistics, of course, is the poor get 5% better and the rich get 4% better, even though the poor proportionally are doing better off, there's still going to be a wider gap nominally between them. That's just how the statistics works out.
Well, the other thing is that, actually, I have in my new version of Healing, I actually have a graph about this, because if you look at wealth creation throughout the centuries, what you see is that we created very little wealth throughout the centuries. You know, if you look at the line from, I think I've got from what, maybe 1600 to the present, you know, it kind of inches up real slowly for most of the world. But something happened around the 1800s that split the developed world from what's considered the undeveloped world today. In other words, the third world kept going at that snail's pace, but in the developed world, we took off. So now there is a bigger discrepancy, but it's not because the third world was somehow plundered. It was because the developed world figured out how to create more wealth. And how did they do that? Through freedom.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you go and you look at, like, all the, they talk about the places in Africa, all the starving in Africa, and it's all the places that have the most totalitarian government.
Of course, exactly. So, bottom line, freedom works. So now that the reason for becoming socialistic and authoritarian is starting to be proven to be false, I think that people are going to say, hey, government doesn't work. Let's get back to freedom.
Yeah. Okay, and one more question. This one is from Web Fusion. And this is probably a better question for your husband, but you're here, he's not. As I see it, only a science-based reclassification is going to get a massive industrial hemp program moving sometime in this decade in the USA. Is there any way in the current political climate to circumvent the legislative process and avoid the Supreme Court by getting the U.S. Agricultural Department to officially recognize the low THC content hemp as not marijuana? Do you know of the name of one senior official in the U.S. Agriculture Department who is willing to stand up in front of media microphones and announce to the President and Congress, hemp is not marijuana, here's the proof?
I don't know of anyone. I think that would be a very interesting project for someone to start talking to people in government about. I started talking to the FDA about problems they have.
Right.
And I actually suggest to some libertarians in a very positive and proactive and collaborative fashion talk to these government officials, because of course a lot of them are not stupid or all power hungry. They care about what they're doing, and if they decide that what regulations and laws they have been enforcing are not productive, someone's likely to stand up. So, seek that person out. There have been a number of things that may change the face of this industrial hemp. We talked here at the convention that we're at, the Carrabas County Convention, about how medical marijuana laws are being passed in various states. And even though the government's trying to put them down, my belief is that once these are established, and they will be because people want the medicine, they're going to take it, they're going to fight for it. I think there's no other reason to keep industrial hemp illegal, and that's my vision of how it may happen, although, of course, there could be other ways, too. So that's
well, it does seem to be a bigger movement in medical marijuana than it is industrial hemp, and I guess because you can not only point to the real facts, but also you can point to, sick and dying people.
Exactly. And, it's funny because the sick and dying people are allowed to have narcotics that are much more addictive. And so as that point has been brought forward, now what they're doing is trying to take the narcotics away from these people. And I don't think it's going to be much longer before you're going to see people in pain trying to shorten their lives and taking a suicide pill of some sort because they can't, they can't bear the pain. I think this is terrible. I think that libertarians are missing an opportunity to really push the idea of, look, this is a compassionate thing to do. We should be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really think that that is the issue that's going to really kill the drug war.
Yeah. Well, I don't know where Web Fusion is going with this, but I could see legalization of industrial hemp is kind of going to the same thing. Hey, I've got a hat made out of this stuff. Hey, here's some paper made out of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it might have kind of the same effect. And that would be something that, you go to the store and here's products made out of hemp. How many of us know someone who's suffering from someone that needs medical marijuana? Not as many of us.
Well, I don't know. I think there's cancer in every family. I know in our family we've been exposed to a lot of it, and maybe not in a young family, but certainly, in the extended family of uncles and aunts and grandfathers and things. I think that, unfortunately, we will be exposed to a lot of it, even if we aren't at the present moment. It's going to be an issue that touches every one of us, and if you see a loved one, as I have, in pain, vomiting because of chemotherapy, just wanting to end their life because they cannot stand it, you're going to want to give them whatever works. And if you heard that marijuana works, it's going to be a lot of people are going to be choosing, unfortunately, to go to the black market, because that's where you've got to go right now, to get them that marijuana cigarette, because it's ridiculous. They have medical THC, but you take it orally. Well, if you're throwing up, how good is that?
Well, I've also heard that if you're smoking the marijuana, somehow, I guess, your body knows how much you need, and you kind of stop at that point.
Right. You can titrate your dose a little more. When you're taking something orally, especially when you're throwing up, you don't know how much you've absorbed. It takes a while to hit you, whereas when you smoke, it gets in your bloodstream right away. So you're very cognizant of, when it's working, and you can titrate your dose much more exactly. It's safer to do it that way.
But if it were completely legalized and we do all this research on it, we might even be able to come up with safer inhalers where you wouldn't have to smoke it.
Oh, by all means.
Breathe it in directly in.
Oh, and there's no doubt about that. We have the technology to do that. There's just no doubt. So it's sad. It's just sad. And to think that we allow people to suffer like that when there's no need, it's just barbaric. And that's how it's going to be looked on years from now.
Yeah. My only real thought, and I don't know if you have any opinions or knowledge on this, but he's talking about just going through the agricultural department and getting them to say, hey, industrial hemp isn't the same as marijuana and stuff like that. Given the attitude the DEA has towards the state medical marijuana laws, I'm kind of wondering if maybe they just ignore that too and just keep doing what they're doing.
Well, you never know. And my thought is that we're kind of called to do certain things sometimes. And if Web Fusion, if Web Fusion feels called that this is something that could work, then I encourage him or her to take an activist position and go and try to work with the agricultural department, because the message we get internally, it's a little, it's all different for each of us. And maybe if that's the message that you're getting, Web Fusion, I'd go for it. If it's just an idea and it doesn't quite feel like it's in your heart, then toss it around intellectually a little bit. And my guess is that you are on the way to getting getting some ideas that will appeal to you and that you'll want to work on and that will actually come to fruition. That's what my guts are telling me.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, another prong in the attack on against the war on drugs is
yes,
very welcome.
That's right. We may need more than one approach. And that's the first time I've heard that one. Clearly you are thinking about that.
It was a new one on me, too.
Yeah. You've got something going here, Bob Fusion, so I wouldn't let go of it. I'd give it a little more thought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I don't really know what they would ask for follow-up questions, so I've been talking mostly for myself here and just reading out what they had. But thank you for taking a few minutes. I guess we talked here about 20 minutes or so. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted that I'm able to share with the people who have questions, and I hope maybe we'll be able to do this again.
Maybe. All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm.